Chernihiv's being bombed relentlessly, but the Russians have spotted this escape route, and minutes after we arrive, they hit it.
That's Alex Crawford, Sky News special correspondent, who's based in Istanbul.
Her work has taken her to the heart of some of the most dangerous conflicts and crises of our times.
We joined the men and women on the front line of the Ebola crisis, collecting Liberia's Ebola dead.
She's covered the Ebola outbreak, the Libyan civil war, the ethnic cleansing of Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar.
And we are the first outsiders here.
And more recently, the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan and the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Mr. President, Alex Crawford from Sky News UK.
During her 30-year career, she's been arrested, detained, abducted, interrogated, and also faced live bullets, tear gas, IEDs, and mortar shells.
Her reporting has won her two Emmys, a BAFTA, an unprecedented 5 Royal Television Society Journalist of the Year awards, and earned her an OBE.
On today's episode of the Meridian podcast, we are thrilled to be speaking with Alex about her career as a foreign correspondent, her reporting from some of the most dangerous places in the world, as well as her thoughts on Ukraine, 1 year on from the Russian invasion, and her experiences with the Taliban's rule in Afghanistan.
Welcome to the Meridian podcast.
So today on the Meridian, we are really excited to be joined by Sky News special correspondent, Alex Crawford. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for asking me.
So I guess the first question, just to sort of paint a picture of your background, you were born in Surrey, but you had quite an unconventional upbringing living in Nigeria, Zambia and Zimbabwe. So given your slightly unconventional background, has that and how has that shaped you both personally, but also professionally? Because as a foreign correspondent, of course, you spend quite some time in different regions. So how has your upbringing impacted you personally, but also in your career?
Well, the most strange thing I find about that sentence that you just did describing me was born in Surrey, because I've never been to Surrey, never lived in Surrey, nothing to do with Surrey, apart from my mother arrived from Nigeria, dumped me there and then took me back. So I feel very little allegiance to Surrey or England. In fact, I spent most of my childhood being brought up in Zambia, and then I went to school in Zimbabwe because there was a war going on between Zambia and Zimbabwe at that time, which was then Rhodesia, and they were fighting for their independence. So I never thought that my upbringing was unusual, but I guess it was, in that, you know, from a very early age, my sister and I were immersed in a civil war, and the only people that were allowed across the border between Zambia and Zimbabwe, we were at boarding school in Zimbabwe, were the school children, and the country of Zimbabwe was already on fire because they were desperately trying to get independence. So from a very early age, you know, about the age of 8 or 9, we were getting used to men with guns, war-type situations. We had terrorist drills at school as well as fire drills. And it struck me that fast forward sort of 25 years, when I took my own children to India, when I had my first posting as a foreign correspondent, they were also doing terrorist drills in their school because it was very soon, whilst we were there, they had the Mumbai terror attack. It just struck me that they were also being brought up in this rather crazy, unconventional way. So I guess it was unconventional. However, that doesn't mean to say that you have to have an unconventional upbringing to be a damn good journalist. I know lots of journalists who've had what you might call a typical British upbringing, you know, with a good British education, and have still gone on to be really good journalists. You know, some of them are people that I would consider my mentors, or people that I would aspire to do equally good journalism as them. So I don't think it matters so much as from where you've come as to where you want to be. And I think if you've got a natural curiosity about the world, about people, about countries, I mean, I know some that doesn't suit everybody, but I get butterflies in my stomach every time I get on a plane, and it's full of excitement and anticipation and interest in where I'm going, what I'm going to see, and who I'm going to talk to. And I think those are probably one of the key ingredients of being a journalist and wanting to be a journalist. And then on top of that, you add layers. You know, foreign correspondent, they're also a particular type of person who leads a very nomadic life, because you will lead a nomadic life. You know, you won't have much stability or security. You will break every dinner engagement you ever make. You will miss birthdays, you will miss Christmases, you will miss every significant, it feels like you might miss every significant you know, occasion in your family. There are sacrifices, but it's an incredible life to live, and I'd wholly recommend it to the people who want to do it, because it's you can make an impact if you want to, you can have a million adventures if you want to, you can go places that no one else has ever been, and you can make a difference. And I think that's probably the backbone of every good journalist.
No, that definitely sounds amazing. I was wondering if you'd be able to talk to us a bit about your journey into becoming a foreign correspondent, so kind of how you got started in the world of journalism, and then what steps you took from there to becoming the incredible correspondent you are today.
Thank you. Well, I took a long time to be a foreign correspondent. I took a very long time, and I'm sure there are quicker ways of doing it. I started off in newspapers. I got a traineeship at Thompson Regional Newspapers, which had its own training scheme. You got adopted by a newspaper. And I got taken on, having applied to absolutely every other newspaper that was represented on my course and being rejected by all of them. I finally got taken on by the Wokingham Times, that esteemed newspaper, which everyone has heard about. It's a weekly newspaper which closed down in the last couple of years, which is very sad. But it was a perfect training ground, you know, for a sort of not very confident, timid person that I was then. And everyone was quite nurturing on that weekly newspaper, and I was given lots of opportunities. And from there, I went to I got taken on by the BBC on a BBC training scheme, which was a superb training. I did radio and television with them, but when I ended up in the newsroom, well, first I went to local radio, which I thought was great fun, in Radio Nottingham. It was absolutely fantastic fun. And again, quite small, at a very active time during the miners' strikes. There was lots to do. And because it was local radio, I'm pretty sure it's not changed all that much. But basically, you'd be sort of, OK, here's the radio car, off you go. And it was just you. You know, I was driving this radio car, having to put up the aerial, broadcast from there, manage what was going on with the picket lines and all the hundreds of flying pickets that were trying that was causing a riot in Nottinghamshire. And you know, you'd be sent off in the morning for the breakfast show at about 5-6 o'clock in the morning, with them saying, careful you don't put the aerial up under a tree, otherwise you'll electrocute yourself and the whole of Nottingham will go into darkness. And that was kind of what we did. And that was also brilliant, because it was just fantastic experience and opportunities, which probably wouldn't get in, you know, if you went straight in to a big national radio or TV or newspaper. And I find a lot of students, young journalism students, that's what they want to do. And I feel like they're missing out a lot on the groundwork, because it's not glamorous, but you will make mistakes. And if you don't make mistakes, you need to worry about why you're not making mistakes. That probably means you're not taking enough risks, and you need to take risks. And you learn through making mistakes. And you don't really want to have and make howlers on a really public national stage where it'll set you back, your confidence and your progress by quite a lot. It's much better to make it on the Wokingham Times or somewhere where no one knows what you're doing, and they're much more forgiving. And then after I went into BBC television, I felt like I was being swallowed in this huge big empire, which was the BBC. I wanted to be a reporter, and I was sort of on the path to being a producer, sub-editor, producer, program editor. That was kind of the path. And I really wanted to do reporting. So I left them, and Sky, this brand new station, was just starting up then, called Sky. Up until then, there were only two television stations, BBC news channels, BBC and ITV. And they were absolute mammoths of the industry and had this sort of cornered this duopoly. And then Sky came along and broke it all apart, did 24-hour news. And suddenly it was very lives here, lives there, breaking news. You know, incredible to think that before that time, BBC hardly ever did anything live, you know, and whereas now it's sort of like commonplace. At Sky, I spent a long time waiting to and trying to get to be a foreign correspondent. I had four children whilst I was there. I finally wore them down. And then I was doing lots of foreign stories before then, but that's not the same as being a foreign correspondent based in a different country. It's very, very different, because once you're in a foreign country and you're either freelance or working for in a bureau or whatever, you basically live and breathe the job, and it's fantastic, and you learn so much about the country, the region, the culture, and that's what I wanted to do.
And obviously a part of that job, as I was reading on Sky's website, they have a description of you, and it says that during your career you've been arrested, detained, abducted, interrogated, and faced live bullets, tear gas, IEDs, and mortar shells. And obviously something that's quite unique to being involved in war correspondency is sort of fear and danger, especially when you're covering conflict. I'm curious to know, how do you sort of cope with fear? Do you cope with fear? And what sort of work goes on sort of behind the scenes and off camera so that you can shoot and that, you know, you can interview people in a safe environment?
Well, the fear thing is, I think it's good to be a little scared, because I'm more than a little scared, but it's definitely, you don't want to lose that fear, because if you're not worried or fearful or sort of, you're probably not taking enough precautions and you're not wary enough about what could go wrong. So you need to be mindful about all the dangers. I mean, I didn't set out to be a war correspondent, and I personally think that's a strange ambition. I fell into it because there was so much going on around where I was working as a foreign correspondent. I started out in India, and there was India, you know, my patch was India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Sri Lanka, all of which were on fire at roughly the same time and probably still have lots of problems now. So there was no shortage in finding hostile environments, but I didn't seek them out. And as I did them more and more, and previously before that, I'd covered lots of, homegrown problems in Britain, where I was working first in Britain. And there were, you know, there were constant IRA bombings, and that was kind of in our backyard, you know, the July 7th, terror attacks in London, the Omar bombings I covered when I was just a very young cub reporter. And I remember knocking on the doors of all the relatives who'd lost their children, because there was a school bus that got blown up as part of the Omar bombings, and finding it incredibly strange, but also privileged. It felt very privileged when they opened the door and wanted to talk to me. And it was almost like a a sort of therapy session for them. You know, they wanted to talk about their dead children and why it had happened and what had happened and the kind of people they were. And that you realise that that's a really special place to be in. And you may be the first person that's walked through that door since they've lost a close relative. And I think in a number of the hostile environments and the war zones, that's what happens. You're the first person as they've been hit, as they've been shot, or whilst it's happening. And you come to realise you've got a very, very delicate job. So it's not just always about managing your own fear and your own risks. It's about how you're dealing with the other people who are incredibly traumatised and frightened. And when you see how they behave, I mean, some of them are, when I was under siege in a mosque in Libya, I mean, there was some astonishing bravery and incredible people doing incredible things under the most extreme, hostile, terrible events. And yet, and also showing such kindness towards strangers like myself and my crew, you realise that in amongst all this terrible shit that's going on, there are these shining examples of humanity. And that's incredibly inspiring. And it also gives you a reason to do it. You know, you're doing it because there are these civilians, this mother, this son, this 15-year-old. You know, there was a 15-year-old boy sitting next to me when we were under siege. He was the same age as my son at that time. And he was all alone. You know, he'd lost everybody and he was just sheltering with us. And I think those connections and always remembering that is probably what helps keep you going and controlling the fear, because there's always going to be people who are a lot more frightened than you and a lot less capable of getting out of that situation. When you're faced with, you know, a town, a village, a household who don't have any options, mm-hmm. your fear is kind of like a bit parked to the side. It's almost embarrassing to feel frightened in those circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something we've perhaps seen a lot of, especially when I've been watching your reporting from Ukraine at the moment. Obviously, we're nearly 1 year into this conflict, and you visited several villages such as Severodonetsk, where people either can't leave or won't leave. And obviously, there's a lot of fear, but then also, as you spoke about, incredible acts of humanity and bravery as well. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit about what your experience has been like covering this sort of civilian side of the war in Ukraine.
Well, I much prefer doing the civilian side. I find mm-hmm. it quite hard to do the armies and the troops, although they're a necessary part of it. And you have to tap into them occasionally, whether they're rebels or whether they're an actual, official army, because you need to get a sense of how it's going. And they're one of the senses of how it's going. Are they demoralized? Do they have the equipment? Do they, you know, are they moving forward or standing still or running backwards? So you do have to do it. But especially with the official armies, they are people who've generally chosen to be in that position, whereas the civilians haven't. You know, I mean, obviously, if we put conscription aside, that's different in the Russian army. But, you know, and also to some extent different in the Ukrainian army, because they haven't chosen that war. Or that's certainly the way they believe it. But they did choose to be in the army, the bulk of the people who are the official army people. And that's very different to old ladies and families and young kids who just suddenly find their town or village or street being occupied by the enemy, tanks and snipers and shooting. I think when we're doing something like that, when my crew, which is very small, because it has to be small, because we have to be able to move generally in one vehicle. You know, ideally we'd try and go with two, but in a lot of time it's just not possible. So we take a medical advisor with us, who sort of medical security I have a producer and a cameraman, and that's it. And we, you know, we might have a local. I've got with Ukraine, I've got a Ukrainian friend, journalist colleague who comes with us everywhere, and he is superb. And he reads the room, because in those areas, particularly the areas that are on the line, borderline with Russia, a lot of them have just been fed Russian propaganda for, you know, 7-8 years and beyond. Many people in the Donbass and the border regions have lots of familial links. They have relatives in Moscow, and long, you know, auntie, uncle, grandma, whatever, are all still living in Russia. So it's a really strange place, because they feel like they're stuck in the middle of this war, and they can't get out of it, because, you know, there's a lot of confusion about, well, why don't they run? And plenty of people did just run to the West and out of the country, to Poland and other places, Britain, for instance. But others, as the war went on, and they either couldn't leave in terms of they were infirm, or and then there were others that just thought, well, if we leave, what happens? Will we ever come back? You know, who's going to live in our house? What's going to happen to our house? You know, and where am I going to? They've got no money to go anywhere. They've got no homes to go to. They've got nowhere else to go. So those are the ones, the hardcore people who stay behind. And I find focusing on the civilians and finding a little bit, you know, if I hadn't focused on civilians, I wouldn't have known all of that. I could have read it in history books, but it's not the same as living and breathing it and talking to them about it. And I think that's sort of the key thing of what we try to do anyway, and any good foreign correspondent tries to do, is sort of go and get themselves on the ground. Because it's so easy, especially now, it's so easy to be misled or misinformed, or, you know, be told, oh, yeah, that city has been taken. And you know, because you've been in it or you are in it. I remember when we were in Lysychansk, which was the last bit of one part of the Donbass to go. And we were phoning back using our satellite link. And that's another key difference in Ukraine, is that they've got all these Starlinks, so everyone can, you know, there's a certain amount of Wi-Fi still available because of the Starlinks, particularly to the army and the police and the authorities and the humanitarian aid centres. But I was ringing the foreign editor saying the Russians are really close. And it had been months, and I said, no, they're really close. We can hear small arms fire. The Ukrainians are pulling out. I said, we're not allowed to say that, because, you know, it's going to compromise their position. We can't say it live now, but they are pulling back and retreating. And that was the first indication that they were about to lose Lysychansk. And I think it was less than 48 hours. The Russians were inside in the same place. Whilst we were there, they were capturing Russians. And I told my foreign editor again, I said, there are dead Russians on the street. That means they've got close enough to either capture them, or they've got inside. But they're close, and they're capturing tanks. And you can't get close to a tank unless it moves close to you. So I think all of that, you know, you talked about I can't remember your question, but it was something about civilians. And I think you gain such a lot of information from the civilians. It was the civilians which led us to the Russian bodies. It was civilians who told us that they could hear people, that they were on the other street, that they were bombing here and shelling there. So you learn a lot from civilians. And you also find out what it's like to live under those circumstances. You know, where do you get your water? How do you wash? You know, how are you getting any food? They're a real font of knowledge. And also, I just think everyone can identify with civilians. They can't always identify with soldiers or with a trained particular profession, but they can identify with, they can see themselves in that person, or their sister in that, or their brother in that. So it's also a good way to connect and get people to care about the story.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned before there's so much disinformation out there, and you also mentioned that you have quite a delicate job. I was wondering, you know, you'll know the common sort of phrase about journalists that they're sort of the first, they write the first draft of history. In Ukraine, obviously, it's an era defining moment, really. How heavy does the responsibility of telling these civilian stories weigh on you as a journalist?
I mean, there's a huge weight of responsibility. And I think from all sorts of points, angles. One, I think, that first of all, you've got a real weight of responsibility in dealing with that person who's in front of you, you know, that very frightened family or that traumatized, you know, angry man or that injured person. That's what I see as my first responsibility, to act like a human, to be normal, not to put your journalist blinkers on and forget that they are people who are suffering, you know, and they may be Russians, they may be Ukrainians, but they're still people at the end of the day. And so as I say, you know, I feel you've got a responsibility to act in a honorable, compassionate, thoughtful way, whatever they're doing. You know, if they've arrested you, if they're holding you prisoner, if they're about to take you hostage, or if they're suffering because they've lost someone, I think you should remember that you're a human first and foremost, and a journalist next. And secondly, I think the writing the first page of history, you've got to remember that you, especially if you're in one side of a conflict, you're only seeing one side. So you have to constantly remember and ask questions and think, why are they saying that? What's the reason? Am I brainwashed because of I live in the West? Am I, you know, not thinking this entirely independently through because I'm also fed propaganda by my government and my side of the world that I live in? And I think that's probably the hardest thing to remember when you're on one side of a war. It's really hard. It's very hard to be, to not feel linked with one side when the artillery is heading towards you and the bombs are landing near you. It's really hard to, that's what you've got to fight against and constantly, you know, look for the alternative and listen to the alternative. A lot of those people in Severodonetsk and Lysychansk had Russian sympathies and wanted the Russians to come in. Not a lot. I can't really say how many, but certainly a number of them. And they, as soon as they saw that we were Western or heard that we were Western, or they viewed us as the enemy. You know, they thought we were going to be biased, and they thought we were probably sent by, you know, America, the West, Britain, you know. And of course, if you're a Russian sympathizer and you're from Britain, they know that your government has supported the war and is supplying, you know, Boris Johnson at that stage was constantly dropping in and talking about weapons and handing weapons and was in the forefront of the Western countries to support the Ukrainian war in a very, very public way. And whatever his motives for doing that, and they may have been entirely selfish, the rest of the Ukrainians saw him as a savior and the Russians saw him as a war criminal. So when they see British Western journalists rocking up, they think you're the equivalent of the RT journalist in Russia, you know, but you're working for the other side. So there's a lot of anger and suspicion, and you have to try and get over that and win, if not win them over, at least listen to their point of view and give them a voice and hear about why they're thinking the way they do. And that can be an incredibly illuminating lesson as well. And so I think if you're writing the first page of history, you have to remember that, and you have to include that as well, or try to. And of course, there's lots about the Ukrainian war that, because we're focused very much on the here and now, we're not looking much further than the here and now. And obviously, someday there will be many more questions and pieces and reports. It's difficult to do it when you're in a moving animal like a war that's shifting territory and taking territory and all the rest of it. There's so much going on a day-to-day basis, but there'll be a long-term impact of all these weapons and all these mercenaries turning up in Ukraine. And there'll be a lot more questions about how nationalistic certain sections are and how right wing perhaps certain sections are, and all the allegations of Nazism probably need to be investigated. Right now the country is focused on trying to repel an invader, but those questions are probably not going to go away and probably need a bit more investigating later on. And you know, the whole landscape, and not just geographically, but also politically, is likely to change in Europe as a result of what's happening in Ukraine. So there'll be a long-lasting impact and stories for probably decades to come for young journalists like yourselves to do over the next decade or so.
No, absolutely. I think it's something I know, especially at university and also working with other journalists, that we're constantly reminded of, that we are living through this moment in history that is going to be so consequential, like you said, for so many decades to come. Speaking of being on sort of one side of war and having shells and mortar and coming towards you, it seems that the war in Ukraine has been sort of particularly dangerous for journalists. There's been sort of a lot of tragic deaths and interviews. You know, your Sky News colleague and Stuart Ramsey was shot whilst reporting. You yourself came under fire outside of Chernihiv. Do you think that sort of war correspondence as a whole is potentially becoming more and more dangerous?
I think it's always been dangerous. There are different dangers depending on what type of war you're covering. This one is very dangerous because it's also long range, and you can't really get out of the way of an artillery shelling. You can try and plot it, and there's an imprecise, it's a very imprecise weapon because it's so long range, but it's also, you don't need to be right under it to really be very badly injured by it. And, you know, of course, as you mentioned, Stuart got shot. So that was very close range. And I think that's probably the reason why it appears more dangerous, because it's in many ways quite a chaotic war, with both sides using this long range artillery. There's not a huge amount of air power, but it's all long range artillery and shelling and grabbing territory and taking over towns and villages. So I think from that point of view, it seems and is quite dangerous. The other thing I think that makes this war particularly different is that many other of the most recent wars in Afghanistan, the Gulf War, Iraq, and it was much more difficult to get into the country if you weren't a fully fledged authorized journalist. Whereas Ukraine has attracted a lot of people because you can fly to Poland and walk over, or Moldova, and it's attracted a lot of young, inexperienced, not just reporters, but also guys who just want to hold guns and shoot people and join and it's attracted a lot of strange and inexperienced types as well. And that makes it more dangerous as well. You know, that makes it more dangerous for everybody. It attracted a massive amount of attention. So quite often you're dealing with dozens and dozens, hundreds of journalists from all around the world. Everyone's very competitive. And I think there was a lot of desire to be the first here, do this, do that. And it is a dangerous war, but I think we probably, as an industry and as a profession, we probably need to try and curb that massive competitiveness and think more acutely about how many risks and whether the risks are worth taking. Does it really make much difference if you go half a kilometre down that road to the general story? I don't know whether it does. Obviously, there's a lot of unpredictability about it as well. So there's some things you can't get rid of. There's some risk you can't take out. There's always going to be a risk when you get on that plane to fly to a war zone. But it's sort of measuring up that risk and making sure you're taking a justifiable risk for the story. Why are you going there? What is the reason why you're going down that road or into that town? And make sure it's a damn good one before you take all those risks.
No, that's really, really interesting actually to hear from a journalist. We've talked about civilians and how you sort of dealt with civilians in Ukraine and also sort of the risks that face journalists. But of course, you also interviewed President Zelensky quite soon after the invasion began. That was quite a short interview. Obviously, there was really tight security there. I wonder what you sort of grasped from his character, having met the man himself. And has that sort of informed how you sort of view the war as it is now that you've actually met the man who is the president of Ukraine?
Mm. Well, we were the first people to get an interview with him. And I think I look from then and now as to how things have changed, how he's changed, particularly, as quite indicative of how the war is going. He's gone from being very nervous speaker in many respects. He didn't want to talk English. I had to basically arm wrestle him to talk English. He was very, I wouldn't say nervous, but definitely wary about the whole setup. Was very wary. You know, the security people were very nervous. There were sandbags everywhere. It was all dark because they didn't want any lights. He got brought in, you know, at the last minute. He was obviously really tired. But he was talking about how he was on the phone all the time talking to world leaders. He was quite impatient because his translator wasn't there. So we used our translator, who was a bit sort of gobsmacked by being with the president, and was a bit slow in the reaction. I remember him being quite snappy with him, saying, "Are you a translator or not?" And I wanted to say, "No, he's not a translator. He's literally a solar panel salesman who we met on the train station and said, 'Can you speak English and help us translate?' Because everyone else was fleeing the country, you know, and he was, you know, a lot of our own fixers and producers who we'd set up, had linked up with before the invasion, fled as soon as everyone, the drivers, everyone left. And then when Stuart's team got shot and, you know, Sky said, "We're going to pull everyone out. You know, Stuart's been hurt. We're trying to get them out. We need you to go in. Can you go in?" And so me and my team went in thinking, and everyone thinking, that Kyiv was going to be under siege for maybe 1 month, 2 months, however, and was going to be encircled. And they were definitely on the up at that stage, the Russians, very definitely. You know, we had a hell of a journey getting into Kyiv because of all the checkpoints, because of all the danger. We had to, the first 24 hours were spent just getting fuel, getting diesel, getting lights, getting water, you know, storing it here, getting a whole load of dry food in case we were under siege for months on end. And then we were monitoring what was happening at Irpin and Butcher and my editor said, "Try and get Zelensky." And I thought, oh my word, this guy is crazy. We're never going to get Zelensky. You know, so anyway, we kept on trying to get Zelensky. And next minute, on the way back from, we spent a day seeing Ukrainian soldiers getting shot as they came closer to Kyiv. And we were on the way back that day. There was tons of them at this hospital, which wasn't even an army hospital. It was just the nearest hospital to the then front line, with dozens of these soldiers coming in terrible state. And then we get a call from the presidential office saying, come and see the president. He's ready to talk. And we went in, and I thought he was tired, a little bit irritable. And the only reason why, well, not maybe not the only reason, I think he knew that our Sky News team had been shot. And he wanted to try and bolster, increase his profile. Maybe, you know, he said, thank you for all you organizations being here, you know, because he needed the media support at that stage. And I think he wanted to show that he was not afraid. Because remember, he was doing a lot of Instagram stuff, or, you know, putting it on social media and doing little clips and of here I am and here I am with my advisors. I'm not leaving. Do you remember there was a lot of talk then about, is he going to leave like Ashraf Ghani, the Afghan leader? And he definitely wanted to, you know, be on a British channel, I think. I don't know whether it was British had anything to do with it, but he definitely wanted to show that he was staying there. He wasn't going to go, and he wanted the West's help, because that's what he kept on repeating. You know, we need to close the skies. We need help. And I've noticed how different he is from then to now, and the circumstances. You know, Sky's Kay Burley did an interview with him just recently. Very relaxed, in plush circumstances, in the palace. You know, happy to talk about, you know, wife, children. You know, the circumstances have changed dramatically for him. Then he was talking about, he was even hinting about giving up parts of the Donbass. You know, he was even hinting at things like that. Now that is not an option now. Now he's going for the full lot. He wants Crimea back as well. So I thought that was very interesting and very illuminating, the different man. He's also grown so much. He's still tiny, by the way, but he has grown so much in stature. And, you know, he's now probably the most well-known leader in the whole world, apart from Putin himself. So the progress has been astonishing.
No, absolutely. I think just watching all the reporting, you can definitely see that he's almost grown more confident in himself and his leadership style, especially watching the address to Congress recently for the first time. Mm. He left the country. That was definitely an amazing moment to see.
Yeah, and he also, his English is so much more fluent, isn't it?
Mm, absolutely. No, it definitely is. Like,
he picked up a few skills along the way, but he knows how to use the media, right? He yes. really knows how to use the media. You know, he made a point of saying hello to our cameraman and being you know, exchanging chats and just really use the camera well.
Yeah.
Use the camera and the opportunity well.
How do you think, having covered this war sort of in its first year, how do you think things are sort of looking ahead as we come up to the 1 year anniversary of the invasion? How is sort of Ukraine looking now compared to
there's no comparison. It's got itself on the world stage. It's virtually got all the Western countries behind it. He personally has got lots of kudos, is judged by the West to have dealt with it very well. He can basically ring up any leader now and say, can you send some tanks? We need a few bit of this and that. I mean, when you think Germany a year ago was umming and ahhing about sending helmets and now is sending tanks. That's quite a big change politically and, you know, in real hard war terms, that's a big shift. And as I say, he's set his sights even higher now, I think. You know, he didn't want to lose anything then. And now he thinks he can smell that he can get it back one way or another. And he's going even further. He wants Crimea back. You know, which they've been fighting for 8 years or whatever. So I think things are going very well for Ukraine, very, very well in those terms. And, you know, if you're a Ukrainian, the people of Europe have basically opened their doors to Ukrainian refugees to the detriment of other refugees and people fleeing persecution, like those from Afghanistan. I mean, they've, you know, there's the two catastrophic events happening in two countries happened so close together, really, in relative terms. And poor Afghanistan has really suffered from being completely overshadowed by what's happening in Ukraine.
Yeah, and that brings us on to Afghanistan. That was exactly what I wanted to talk about. You worked on a fearless, it was a brilliant documentary for Sky recently, investigating sort of the plight of Afghanistan's women. You've been to Afghanistan several times. What was it like on your most recent visit, and what felt different on the ground?
I did my first story on Afghanistan when I was pregnant. And I remember talking to the Taliban were in power then and were just about to be toppled. And now when I went back, that fetus that was in my tummy is now a 20-year-old university student who is studying what's happening in Afghanistan. And that made me think of how long her whole life has been, that whole war has been rumbling on one way or another. And that country's been held to account by men with guns. And I think the Taliban, I spent most of those 20 years, they got toppled, they put in a new government, and then the international troops did some good, but they did a lot of killings and a lot of things that will leave a running scar through that country for centuries, decades to come. And there's a lot of hate towards the international troops because of the insecurity they created, you know, because of the Bagrams, which were basically the Guantanamo Bays in Afghanistan, where they just arrested anybody and there was no real rule or justice. It was just, there was no judge and jury. There was just, you know, a Western soldier, in Bagram's case, American, who just, all right, you're a Taliban, you're a terrorist, come in. And they never got out, or they got out years later. So there's a lot of hatred and fear towards the international community. That doesn't mean that they welcomed the Taliban, and the Taliban are doing exactly what they said they would not do, which is basically under the guise of Sharia law, they're bringing in all sorts of very challenging laws and a way of life that's really impossible for women and young women and girls who have, you know, a whole generation's growing up believing that they were being empowered and working towards having careers and having a voice and helping other women and having jobs and an education. And now that's all been rowed back, you know, in a nanosecond, it's all been rowed back, and they're back to, well, you know, they're back to sort of struggling to have a voice or any real role in Afghan society.
No, absolutely. And I thought it was interesting how you talked about your own daughter, because personally, we had been in Afghanistan longer than I'd been alive. So for me to watch the withdrawal, it was, because I was born just a couple months after 9/11 and the subsequent invasion. So like, we'd been in Afghanistan my entire life. So to then watch the withdrawal, it was just a real shock. It was amazing to watch all of the reporting from there, but just so sad to see somehow how desperate the Afghan people were when, especially in Kabul at the fall. I was wondering what sort of trajectory you think Afghanistan might be on for the future. So you mentioned about women being denied education. Do you think there's any chance of the Taliban sort of going back on that, or do you think they're heading straight back to the way things had been pre-invasion?
At the moment, it doesn't look like they're in any mood to row back. I think there might be some internal problems or challenges within the Taliban setup. There's different factions, you know, one faction which is a bit more progressive and another faction which is much more hardline. And at the moment, the hardliners are winning the battle. And it's very difficult to see how that is going to change in the short to medium terms. It just looks like it's going to get a lot worse. And because the world is kind of turning away and doesn't want to tackle it. And there's an argument that maybe they shouldn't have tried to tackle it in the first place, and that their motives were not entirely pure in going there in the first place. But they've left one hell of a mess. And, you know, there'll be lots of people, some in Afghanistan themselves, who'd argue that, you know, after 20 years and, you know, spending so much money, that they have a sort of duty to try to at least take some sort of responsibility for what's been left behind. But that doesn't look like that's happening anytime soon. And I think it's a really, really grim future for those there at the moment. And anyway, even if everything's the Taliban have a change of heart or people rise up, neither of which looks likely in the next, you know, 5, maybe 10 years, those are 5 years of some woman's life. During that time, they will not get an education. They will not graduate. They will not be able to work. You know, they might be married off to a Taliban fighter. You know, so much can happen in that time that could change people's lives irrevocably. And I just feel very sad about Afghanistan. I think it's a terrible, terrible, terrible mess. And the people in there, especially the women, have so few options. I feel, really, really bad for them. And I don't know, I really don't see a way forward at the moment. It certainly needs a lot more people and a lot more countries and a lot more governments to stand up and try and be a bit more instrumental in trying to encourage or develop progress. And at the moment, they're not. I mean, you know, the whole Doha talks didn't really include women. And that I find astonishing. I just find that astonishing. And the whole pullout thing was done without, I mean, you know, we had a different president of America then, but just the whole thing is so shockingly sort of badly organized. You could have more or less predicted it, that this is the case that we'd be left with after all those wrong decisions. But that doesn't mean it can't be changed for the future if good, strong people come through. But immediately, I can't see how that's going to happen.
Yeah. You mentioned there that you just feel kind of overwhelmingly a sadness about Afghanistan. There was a really touching moment in that documentary where you meet a woman called Brishna who'd fled Afghanistan. And she was talking about the women that were still there. And she said, if you could just go meet them, see them and be a voice for them, that's all that she wanted. Is your fear that women and the Afghanistan crisis in general is going to be forgotten? And how do you do something like be a voice for people? It sounds so, so simple, but such a remarkable thing that she was asking of you, and such a level of responsibility on you.
Yeah, I know. I was gobsmacked. Like, what? Please don't make me that voice. It's a huge responsibility. It feels like an incredible, I mean, just massively a big privilege to when someone asks you that. But and we did our damned best. But yeah, I'm really worried that people will forget about it, and not will forget about it, are forgetting about it. So thank you for bringing it up, and thank you for asking about it, and thank you for being so sensitive and wanting to hear about it, because that is the worry, that the next generation in particular doesn't, because you're the ones that are going to change it. Your generation is, that's, you know, our generation has completely fucked up everything. Your generation is the one that's going to have to going to, you know, really come through. And so it's, and I think you're a lot more caring, you know, judging by my own children, a lot more caring, much more worldly. You're not stuck in your blinkers of we're from Britain, we're only going to concentrate on Britain. You're much more in tune with what's happening in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Yemen, whatever. And you care about things like the climate change. So, yeah, over to you now, guys. Can you save us?
I'm sure I can speak for both myself and Mike and say if we become half of the journalists that you are, we will be doing a damn good job. Yeah. And we are incredibly, incredibly grateful to you for taking the time to speak with us today. It's been so interesting to hear your perspective on so many of these issues. And thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for asking me. And thank you, the two of you. As I said, I really meant it. If you can touch many your fellow students or any the young people that are listening to this to make them care about things like Afghanistan and what's happening in Ukraine, you're doing a good job. So thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Meridian podcast. We hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as we enjoyed creating it. If you liked what you heard, why not subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts so our latest episode lands in your feed. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram and TikTok too, at The Meridian Podcast. And if you've got an idea for an episode or would like to appear, send us an email at meridianpodcast@gmail.com. This episode was presented and edited by Michael Gorham and Amelia Hardy. The theme music is Impending Uncertainty by Gavin Luke and Solar Flare, licensed by Creative Commons. Until next time, thanks for listening.